Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. Here, an artist's conception of how the feat was accomplished. A three-stage rocket. Number one, the booster in the class of an intercontinental missile. Its weight estimated at 50 tons.
This is a newscast from 1957, when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1, the first satellite to orbit the Earth. The visuals for the broadcast were drawn like a cartoon, since the United States had no footage of the event.
You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite. One of the great scientific feats of the age.
Fast forward 60 years, and we're at the precipice of a new space race, this time to get to Mars. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to meet a KU grad student who just led a team that won an international competition to design a spacecraft that could orbit Mars and make it back home. Bailey Miller, hello.
Hi, Gina.
So, first of all, the whole idea of a space race sounds sort of old-timey, but there is this new competition to get to Mars, and it's not nation versus nation. It's almost like corporation versus corporation.
Yeah, that's right, and it's very exciting to see that we're having a commercial space race now compared to the nation versus nation that we had in the Apollo era.
Can you tell me more about it? Because it's not something that the average person talks about in quite the same way that people used to talk about who would be first to land on the moon.
Yeah, so essentially we've got a couple of public companies trying to fight against each other. We've got SpaceX and Boeing, who are two really big contenders right now that are, I mean, facing off even on Twitter. They have been known to kind of talk some smack, and it's been exciting just to see that they have their own plans going forward just to put people on Mars. And that's just kind of the next step forward that we need to have as a spacefaring species, really.
You consider us a spacefaring species?
Yes, I do. Very much so.
Tell me more about that. Because that is not how I would describe humanity, but I'm not you.
Yeah, I would think that we're getting there. Maybe not. That's not a good descriptor yet, but moving forward, I think that's where we need to be going. I think there needs to be more humans in space. I think we need to get comfortable with the idea that we want to be a multiplanetary species and that we want to move further away in our little neighborhood of our galaxy and our universe.
Why do we want that?
Advance. I mean, some of the best technological advances that we've ever had have come from exploration and just from competition. So if we're moving forward trying to do new things, I mean, technology is going to come with it, and quality of life is going to come with it, and all of these good things are going to come if we can just push forward.
Okay, I'm going to get back to your feelings about space in general and Mars in particular in just a minute, but tell me about the competition you just won, first of all. How did it work?
So what we were given was this prompt. And what they asked us to do was to design a spacecraft that would take humans to and from Mars orbit. And we had a budget limitation of $5 billion. And what they wanted us to do was to demonstrate technologies that would be needed for future deep space missions and also for use on future landing missions on Mars.
So who is they? Who sponsored this competition and who were the competitors?
It was AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They're the ones who sponsor the competition, and it's an international competition. Any university is able to compete, and it was an only undergraduate competition.
So this was, you're a grad student now, but this was when you were in college.
That's correct. It was my undergraduate capstone class, our spacecraft design class here at KU.
So what would you say ultimately set your group's design apart, that you won this thing? That is pretty crazy.
Yeah, I think there was a couple factors. We kind of thought about different technologies that we would certainly need, such as like nuclear reactors and stasis chambers specifically, and also methane and ISRU, in-situ resource utilization technologies that may be used for landing, as well as using reusability. When the spacecraft was done and the crew was home, we would actually leave the spacecraft in orbit and then it would be used for future missions. And then just critical thinking in general and the research that we did, just examining the numbers and using our engineering judgment that we've accumulated over the first 4 years of our undergraduate careers to really think about the numbers we're getting and see if they're viable or not.
What are the big challenges in getting humans to Mars? I mean, humans surviving on Mars is an entirely other question, but just getting people there, what's the big holdup?
If we're thinking about our current situation, I think it's it could be a combination of funding for the public companies like NASA, as well as just a unified vision going forward. Over the past couple of administrations, we've said, hey, let's go to Mars. But the steps to get there have changed. So if you change the recipe while you're cooking, it's never going to come out well. So I think we need to have some unified vision going forward that's not affected by any administration, and then just go for it and follow those steps.
But then, I mean, as far as engineering challenges, like the kinds of things that you and your crew had to wrestle with to submit a design for
sure.
This competition.
So making sure that the humans were comfortable was a really big thing. We put in a VR headsets for all of the crew. That way they could have something to do on the 300-day space flight between here and Mars. We also had stasis chambers, which would essentially put them in like this induced coma for like 2 weeks at a time, just to kind of make it go a little bit quicker, but also for proving technologies for, let's say we were going to Titan later on. That would take much longer, so you kind of wouldn't want to spend the time just floating around doing nothing. But there's also the issue of radiation in space. It's kind of a big deal, but solving that problem, we're not quite there yet, but I think some of the solutions we came up with were very good for our use, at least.
It seems like dealing with things like the effects of radiation and boredom, that doesn't necessarily seem like the terrain of an engineer.
Yeah, honestly, this whole spacecraft design, it took us out of our box a little bit. We were used to just kind of thinking, like, here's the math, just do the math. But really, we had to think about all of the situations, all of the possible outcomes of anything, and try to fix it and come up with solutions to different problems we've never expected before.
So you were saying just a minute ago that part of the challenge in getting to Mars is also not an engineering problem, and that is that politics keep, as the political pendulum swings from one side to another, so do the plans for how to get to Mars, which, yeah, doesn't seem like it gives people who are professionally working toward that much of a chance to make progress. Can you explain that a little bit more, though? I mean, is that part of why you're not just dead set on getting on a NASA mission?
Yeah, and it's kind of a hard question to answer. It's personal views on how we want to move forward. I think, so a lot of people want to go to the moon, and that may be a good step and a good proving ground, but really we need to have a little bit more focus. And it's having somebody like an engineer. Like, I was recently reading Buzz Aldrin's book, his mission on Mars, and his unified vision going forward. I think we just need to have somebody who's been in it, who's been in the industry, seen a spacecraft go from nothing to everything, and have them push us forward and have that clear-cut vision of how we're going to get there.
Why? So you've explained that you see us as a space-faring species. Why do you personally want to go to Mars?
I think of it as more of an exploration need or a want, excuse me.
Like a travel destination that's calling you. It's something else.
Yeah, just kind of the new things that nobody has ever seen before. That's what I'm looking for. It's not necessarily like, hey, I went to Mars. It's, I want to find something on Mars.
Is there any part of you, though, that has like a feeling of caution, even something like the effect that humans might have on another planet? I think it's
certainly
maybe
yeah.
fair to say that we have not taken great care of the Earth.
Yeah, no, that's a very fair point. But I think if we were to go to Mars, we have to develop some new ways to think about things. And I mean, even some of our exploration on Mars and some of the technological advances we would get going there could help us here back on Earth and help maybe mitigate some of the issues we're having with climate change or any of that sort of thing. It really can't be a bad thing, is all I can put out there.
It can't be bad to go to Mars.
I don't think so.
You know, it's my understanding that it takes so long to get to Mars that the first people who go are maybe kind of unlikely to make it back.
Yeah, that is a definite possibility.
And that's something that's undaunting to you?
I would not say it's undaunting. I think about it a lot. And if I were given that call, I would definitely have to sit down with my loved ones at that time and really contemplate, am I going to go? I think right now, if I was given that call, I would go. I would settle on Mars. But it would definitely have to do with where I am at in my life at that time.
When you daydream about this, can you paint the picture for me?
Oh, I imagine coming out of an Eagle-style lander and just looking at that red surface and slowly descending down the ladder and just trying to hold my thoughts together. And I can't even imagine what I would say if I were the first person on Mars. And I think I would just be flabbergasted by the view, just whatever is in front of me, knowing that no other person is on this planet other than the people that are behind me in this crew capsule. It would just be almost lonely, but perfectly lonely.
Huh? You know, you were just making me think about, you know, those words, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, when you said you don't know what you would say. Have you tried to imagine, like, what words, if not coming from your mouth, just would capture just anyone's mouth, what it would mean for humanity?
So one of my favorite quotes, and something that I think has really brought me to where I am today, is by my favorite Toy Story character, Buzz Lightyear, to infinity and beyond. I think those words right there, if we were to actually step on Mars, could mean something, and I think they're very important.
So, you know, getting back to just the your personal career and your own story and all of this, how are you trying to make yourself one of those people who's on that first trip to Mars?
So one thing I'm doing right now is I'm trying to get my PhD here at KU in aerospace engineering. And one of my friends is actually working down at Johnson Space Center, and he got this seminar about what they are looking for in an astronaut candidate. And the couple things that they were looking for were experience in extreme environments, having piloting experience, having a graduate degree, and having scuba experience. And I'm trying to do all of those things. That's my current goals right now.
So like, how are you getting experience in extreme environments?
So with my PhD program, my advisor actually just came back from Antarctica earlier this month. And that's one of the analogous environments that specifically NASA likes to see on a resume. And there is potential that I would be able to go there or to Greenland, which is also close proximity to that analogous environment.
It is pretty crazy to me to think of, like, going to Antarctica seems like an expedition in itself, not just, you know, a stepping stone to prove that you might have what it takes to go on an even crazier expedition. That's intense. Do people in your life, like, worry about this?
About me going to Antarctica?
Yeah, and just about, I don't know, I
feel
some
like
people have parents who freak out if they go to, like, another country that's perfectly climate comfortable. You know what I mean?
Yeah. With Antarctica, I don't think people are as worried about me. I think people are much more worried that I want to go to Mars so badly. I keep hearing, like, oh, you need to come back, all of this stuff. And I don't think they're as worried about Antarctica, really.
So you're hoping to go to Antarctica or Greenland to get your experience in extreme environments. What are some of the other steps that you're going to take coming out of what you've heard from your friend about what both companies and NASA are looking for?
So currently I'm working on my pilot's license here at the Lawrence Municipal Airport. I am going to be getting some scuba experience after that's completed. And then I'm getting my graduate degree right now, and so I'm just slowly just trying to check things off that list.
When you think about going to Mars, I mean, how far back do you know how far back this particular dream goes for you?
For me specifically?
Yeah.
I would honestly say it might go back to Buzz Lightyear. I really would.
Like your first
time? When I first saw Toy
Story. How old were you?
Oh, I must have been 3 or 4 years old.
Do you remember what it was about that story that inspired this? It's a story that so many kids are really fond of.
I think it was just this picture of being in space and being completely weightless and just wanting to experience that. And then as I got older and older, it just formed into this dream where, I mean, Mars started to be in the news and started to become a reality, like we want to go there. So that was my goal.
Bailey Miller, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
When we return, the words of James Baldwin, did they influence or touch you? Call 816-235-2888 to tell that story. 816-235-2888. KCUR Central Standard will be right back. This is old footage of James Baldwin from the documentary I Am Not Your Negro.
It is entirely up to the American people whether or not they're going to face and deal with and embrace this stranger whom they maligned so long. What white people have to do is try to find out in their own hearts why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. If I'm not the nigger here, and you invented him, you, the white people, invented him, then you got to find out why.
A special screening of the movie I Am Not Your Negro was at the Gem Theater last week, and it was sold out, packed wall to wall with people. So we thought that for those who couldn't get a seat, we'd host a discussion of our own, not about the movie, but about James Baldwin himself and how he inspires local thinking on race and so much more today. If James Baldwin wrote something that changed you, that influenced how you see the world, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'd like to start with Cecilia Belzer-Patton. She's a teacher at Pathway Academy, and she wrote her college thesis on James Baldwin. So she can give those listeners who may not be super familiar a quick intro. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So if I were to ask you, who was James Baldwin and why did he matter, what would be your answer?
Oh, wow. I think that James Baldwin was one of the most powerful intellectual figures of American history, not only Black history, but American history. And I think that he is powerful because of his insistence on the truth, his insistence on excellence, and his insistence on American excellence, specifically geared towards dominant culture, white people.
What do you mean by that exactly?
I mean that we have this thing that is the American dream and these things that we say that we believe in, which is the right for all people, that everyone is created equally. And he was insistent about making sure that dominant culture held up their end of the bargain on that and didn't allow things like guilt, fragility, privilege, and elitism get in the way. And he did that at a time when he was one of the first kind of people that pushed that forward. So I think that in modern historical context, he's our precursor to Ta-Nehisi Coates, to Eddie Cloud Jr., who are the Black intellectual, public intellectuals of our time. And we are definitely standing on his shoulders for how we move in that way.
You know, we heard his voice just a moment ago, mm-hmm. and I think it is impossible not to be struck by the unflinching mm-hmm. power of his words.
Absolutely.
And the way he speaks them.
Absolutely. There are quotes, there are dozens of quotes that I was able to find in which he incorporated that in all of his speech. Things about fragility and guilt, things about this imagination of whiteness that white people have happened upon in American society. One was people who imagine that history flatters them are impaled on their history like a butterfly on a pin and become incapable of seeing or changing in themselves or their world. And I think that he was unflinching. He was
It gives you goosebumps. It's just so precise. Yeah.
Yes. And he was that way. He was that way in all of his speech, in all of his writing, in all of his holding us all accountable, and especially white people accountable to the effects of racism on our society.
Do you remember when you first discovered his work?
Yes. I was an English major, but even before that, my mother was an English teacher in the Kansas City, Missouri School District before she went on to become an administrator in Kansas City and suburban districts. And so as an English teacher, our walls were covered with books. And I remember coming across Go Tell It on the Mountain when I was in sixth grade. And she told me I wasn't quite ready to read it. And so, of course, since she said that, I read it under the covers at night. And so from that, really loved the fervor of his voice, the insistence of his identity and being seen, his unflinching quality about making sure that he was who he wanted to be, and he created that identity and defined himself as he wanted to. And that spoke to me very much as a person who grew up in Raytown and Lee Summit in a time when Raytown and Lee Summit doesn't look like it does today.
What do you mean by that? What did it look like?
It was very white. You know, I could not find myself in the hallways. It was me in the hallways and just a few others. And so I used to make jokes about that I was a fly in a quart of milk. And that's what it felt like. And so to be able to identify myself, to define myself, and to create my identity for myself without the kind of centering of whiteness was a challenge. And I think it was a challenge for Baldwin, too, even in Harlem in that time, of how do you allow yourself to be who you say you are and not who others say you are?
Yeah, you know, I've been reading some essays by him lately, and there's one called Letter from a Region in My Mind that really, like, I had so many moments, you know, where you sort of instinctively put your hand to your heart or something, like you just, you have to physically respond to what you just read. And he writes about being an adolescent and for the first time understanding how a person can end up being out on the streets in trouble. Like, he starts imagining that that could happen to him for the first time in his life. And he writes about about being scared that the things he was good at were not the things he saw Black people succeeding in, things like music or sports. And I feel like, yeah, I can hear some of what you're talking about there, too, that, yes, he was surrounded by Black people, but he still wasn't seeing himself.
Well, I think if you think about in times that James Baldwin grew up in Harlem in the 30s and 40s. Definitely there was a presence there. There was an intellectual presence there. W.E.B. Du Bois was his precursor, right? Yet, I think that the reality of who we are as Black people and the reality of the dream of who we could be and who we could continue to be and who we could have been, there's stark contrasts that come in with that. And I think that even as we try to break out of those molds of what we see our families do, our neighbors do, or our overall community do, the reality of trying to do that is something in and of itself. Because of the systems of racism, because of the institutionalized ways in which we've been oppressed. And so I think as a person growing up in a household where his father was a Pentecostal preacher, who was his stepfather, and who seemed to have been very upfront about his hatred for his stepson, to be able to figure out how to create a space for yourself that is one's own, I think is, it's a challenge to do, even for the best of us, and even for the brightest of us, as James Baldwin was, it can be a challenge to do. And so to become aware of that as an adolescent, of that you have this high aspiration paralleled with the stark reality of what life is, I think is something that he grappled with his entire life.
Do you bring that sensibility from him to your work in education, your work with young people?
Yes, and I'm no longer in the classroom,
oh, okay.
So I just wanted to put that out there. I actually facilitate around restorative practices and the cultural competencies of diversity, inclusion, and equity in education. And for sure, you know, this reality of what we say we do and what we actually do is a totally different thing. And I think Baldwin was always on the forefront of making sure that we remembered that. He was on the forefront of reminding us, as he said, that our society had a rigid refusal to look at oneself. That was one of his quotes. And he was talking about white people in that they have a rigid refusal to see themselves. And a part of that is that if you actually see yourself, if you actually see the society in which we stand, if we actually notice the things that are being said in modern day context, and then we don't say anything about it, we act as if that's normal, we act as if that kind of behavior is what is, then yes, we have to move forward and push. You know, my friends and my colleagues call me insistent. They call me, I'm probably like a bull in a china shop in some of those ways of making sure that we do not allow ourselves to be mediocre. And I think one of the only places in American culture, American society, where we allow ourselves to not even be mediocre, but to be subpar, is in the way in which we treat our people of color. We make very definite choices about pretending like racism doesn't exist. We make very definite choices when we have a president that says things like shitholes about people of color nations, and we act like that that is not a thing. We act like that that is not conversation that we should have at our dinner table or with our friends or family when they make similar comments. And that is a rigid resistance to look at oneself.
So I guess you just kind of, in some ways, by referring to the current administration, answered my question that was next about whether there is anything, any passage, any idea from James Baldwin that you experienced one way when you were that little kid under the covers, secretly reading Go Tell It on the Mountain, and how maybe something about that has changed as you've become an adult or as you've entered our current political era.
I figured you would ask a question similar to that. So one of the ones that I think is amazing that he has done is, America sometimes resembles an exceedingly monstrous minstrel show. The same dances, same music, same jokes one has done or been the show so long, one can do it in one sleep. And I think that we're in this minstrel show and that we feel like that we have come so far. We feel like that we're post-racial because we elected President Obama, and yet we behave as if we're in the 1940s, 50s, and earlier. We say the things that we say. We have the beliefs that are being held about people, and we act as if we cannot move forward from that. We are caught in a minstrel show. And I think that James Baldwin is so relevant now because in looking at I'm Not Your Negro, if it were not in black and white, and if we did not know that that was set from thoughts of the 1950s, 1960s, and perhaps early 70s, we could have been right in 2017. And I think for most people, I don't want to seem like that most people do not want to move forward. I think some people are stopped by guilt. Some people are stopped by fragility. Some people are stopped by the overwhelmingness of what racism is and what oppression is, that we would like to think that we would move forward, and yet we don't because we're stuck. And for white folk, it's easy for white folk to be stuck because there is not this oppressive thing that is sitting upon them all the time. For us as people of color, we cannot afford to be stuck. We cannot afford to be overwhelmed. We cannot afford to not move out of this minstrel show. And so I think that Baldwin reminds us of that day in and day out.
Cecilia, hang on with me because I want to bring someone else in on this. I want to talk to D. Rashawn Gilmore. He's the founder of an organization called Blackout, which is working to ensure the health of young gay black men in Kansas City. And he also has a radio show on KKFI, Unbossed and Unbothered. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Gina. Glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
So James Baldwin is personal for you.
In a very real way. So I think I experienced Baldwin differently than most people and differently than even most black people. Because one of the things that I love about Baldwin, and Cecilia hit upon this, is that he shows up in every space as fully who he is 100% of the time. And that really is something that I try to emulate in my life. That is not only his personal integrity, but that again is his insistence on being visible and how he shows up in the world. So he's not just black or gay. He's both. It's like people ask me all the time, it's like asking me, are you a Kansas Cityan or a Missourian? Well, I'm both. And I'm both equally, and I'm both fully, and I'm both 100% of the time. And Baldwin gave space for that for little black gay boys who didn't have any visible representation of that in popular culture at the time.
Do you remember the first time you heard about James Baldwin, read his words, knew who he was?
I do. And I'm almost somewhat ashamed to say that I came to Baldwin somewhat later in life. I mean, within the last 7 years, actually. But it says something to me about the public education that I received, that such a brilliant mind was not already known to me, but also that there was an opportunity for me to engage more. And it was really around a quote of his that said, to be a Negro in this country is to almost always be in a constant rage, because that's the space we live in, where we're always being needled. And I feel like even given the current administration and the current times that we live in, we remain in that space. And so we have this sort of hyper awareness about race and racism and the structures that support it that most often white people do not.
Talk to me more about the sexuality piece of it.
He did not lead with his sexuality, I will say that, but he was never afraid of it. And I don't know if, you know, part of his refusal to repress came from that environment with his stepfather, who was this preacher and very, very rigid with him, or if it was because he had an opportunity for expression when he moved to Paris at 24 and he wrote Giovanni's Room and allowed his mind to freely explore what a gay relationship could look like or could be like. But the influence that he had on so many others who were LGBT, whether Langston Hughes or Lorraine Hansberry or others, I think is really profound.
When I read an interview with him where he was asked why he went to Paris, and it wasn't so much about going to France as it was about leaving the United States, he said that he was afraid that New York basically was going to kill him if he didn't leave. Can you talk to me about that sentiment? When you talk about being needled, that's the extreme of that.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because yesterday was the King holiday, Martin Luther King holiday, and we think of Dr. King in very reverential sort of terms, but the reality of it is, as a good friend of mine, George Johnson, said recently in a tweet, you know, they only loved MLK after they killed him. And so I don't think that in the time that he lived in, he was as celebrated, even though he was a best-selling author, a playwright, all these things. People, you can imagine white America sitting in their living rooms watching television interviews or listening to radio interviews with James Baldwin and cringing at the thought of some of the things he was saying. But the reality of it is, he, I think, really needed to, for his own, if not for his physical safety, his emotional and mental well-being, had to flee this country and to find space for himself in Paris.
I want to bring one more person in on this. Gwen Grant, she's with us from the Urban League of Greater Kansas City. That's an organization dedicated to economic empowerment, educational opportunities, and civil rights for underserved communities. Hi, Gwen.
Hi.
So tell me about your earliest encounters with James Baldwin, his ideas, his persona.
Growing up, seeing him on TV, I believe I remember the interview, which was in I Am Not Your Negro, being interviewed by Dick Cavett on The Dick Cavett Show. And I was really, struck by his intellect, his ability to articulate the issues without fear of retribution, to be truthful about how he viewed race in America. I do want to insert something here that relates to the previous conversation about why he fled this country. I think he struggled with being black and being gay, because as being black or being Negro at that time, he was rejected by white people, but being gay, he was rejected by both black and white people, because being gay is a challenge in the black church. And that, growing up in the home of a Pentecostal preacher and being rejected because of his sexual identity, was another critical factor in his deciding to leave this country. I was struck by his writing, which also was not a part of my public education. It came through have my own pursuits in studying African American history and taking classes with Dr. Ed Beasley, who taught African American history at Penn Valley years ago. That's when I had the opportunity to be exposed to his literary contributions. But, as I remember reading about him and thinking about what drew him back, I think we talk so much about why he left and maybe not enough about why he returned. And in his commentary on that issue is relative to he was an observer or a witness to the civil rights struggle, witnessing it from afar, watching on TV when the student, 15-year-old Dorothy Counts, was integrating the school. And her, you know, she was surrounded. There was this image of her being surrounded by all the white students, and they were, you know, she was spat upon, she was ridiculed, and he felt shame and guilt that he felt like we should have been there with her. She should have had the support, and that's what drew him back to America, and with a focus and or a desire to write about Medgar Evers and Malcolm X and Dr. King. And he spoke with such honesty about the fact that he was ashamed and that he could no longer be in Paris and be as a witness to what was happening in our country, and he wanted to come back and be a part of it. So I think those are the things that really were striking for me.
Can you take me back to that first time you saw him on television? About how old were you?
I'm not going to say that. I'm not answering that question.
Can you? Okay.
If let I can me. Be perpetually 30, Gwen, you're okay.
I was young.
Yeah.
Younger than I am now.
More to the point, can you help me understand the context, like what it was that was so striking to you about seeing this man on television?
Well, when I was coming up, living in a segregated society, seeing black people in positive lights on TV was a rare occurrence. So anytime that happened, it was a big deal in the household. You sit around the TV and you watch black people being, you know, on, you know, in various roles. Well, to watch James Baldwin, who was a brilliant mind, who was poised and no matter how cutting his words, they were always smooth as silk. Yeah. So it was just really, that's the dynamic that surrounded that for me.
A phrase that came up earlier in this conversation was public intellectual. And that's an interesting phrase. And I wonder if you guys can just talk to me about the importance of James Baldwin having been this public intellectual.
Actually, I just have to say that one of the pieces that is crucial here is that he wasn't just a public intellectual. And I think that he gets framed that way a lot. But he was, in my mind at least, the principal public witness. So if you think of a crime, you may have the victims, and of course they are witnesses in effect, right, or in fact, but then you have someone who watches the whole thing. And so what Baldwin did so eloquently throughout his life was hold up the mirror to white America and say, look at yourself. Mm-hmm. And he did it in a way that was unflinching. They could not turn away. They had to look at it. And so, yes, he's a public intellectual, but I think that does somewhat of a disservice to his real role as sort of the voice of the conscience of white America vis-a-vis racism.
I agree with that. And I also think that his role as public witness, public observer, and public intellectual are all a part of the same frame.
Yes.
I think that one of the things that he did is that he was one of our first public black intellectuals, in that at the time, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois was definitely there. Langston Hughes was there. County Cullen, all of the people of the Harlem Renaissance. And that was still, though, very much geared towards whiteness as the center. He was the first person that kind of really moved that put that mirror up against our society, that said in a way that was very intentional, very specific, and very insistent that you look at yourself, right? The other people that had done that type of work were observing, were witnessing, were public, were artistry. And yet his was with a pointed insistence on moving away from anything that made you forget that we do not believe in your white supremacy. He was the first person that said, we do not believe in your white supremacy, and we're going to make you know that.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we still have a little time for the passages and ideas about from Baldwin's legacy that inspire you. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking with three Kansas Cityans who have been inspired and influenced by James Baldwin and recognize in a very passionate way his relevance today in 2018. Those are Gwen Grant of the Urban League of Greater Kansas City, D. Rashawn Gilmore of Blackout, helping young gay black men in our city stay healthy, and Cecilia Belzer-Patton from Pathway Academy. Welcome back, everyone.
Great. Okay. Good to be back.
So, talk to me, Cecilia, about what you see as James Baldwin's real legacy like today, in what's happening today in our world.
I think his legacy that he leaves us today is the legacy that opened up spaces like the Black Lives Matter movement, that opened up spaces of intentional social justice and racial justice continuing in a way that we haven't seen since the Civil Rights Movement, with the insistency and the urgency that comes with it. I think that without James Baldwin, it would have been challenging for us to open up into a Black Lives Matter movement, which basically says that we are rejecting the belief of white supremacy. Baldwin was the first person that publicly held up that mirror to white supremacy, to oppression, to racism in our society in a way that said, this is your responsibility. It is not our responsibility to do it. And Black Lives Matter, I think, came about because of that. I think things that we tend to want to do things in a very shortcut type of way. You know, there's all these things out there now about Michelle Obama and Oprah Winfrey running for office in 2020, because I think dominant culture is very comfortable with us cleaning up mess. And James Baldwin said, no, it is for you to clean up your own mess and look at yourselves and to make some changes.
Let's just say, I think that brings about a broader point, too, which is that very often, you know, black people are expected to have the answer to how do we fix racism. I've been asked that question so many times. How do we fix it? Well, we didn't invent it. It's not our problem to create. But I think a few things are really important to understand. One is that you can't reach racial reconciliation until we have this racial reckoning. And the first part of that is a racial awakening, which is what I think Baldwin began to usher in. And I think going further than that, I think black people and white people use two different metrics and for judging or measuring how far we have come and where we need to go. But I think that white people look at, and this is what I derive from a lot of what I take from Baldwin, white people look at where we have come from to where we are now and say, well, we no longer have slavery. We no longer have this. We've had a black president. We're done. But for black people, we look at how far we have to go until we reach true racial equity, racial parity.
Gwen, you wanted to talk a little bit more about some clips we've played previously in this hour, clips about what segregation means, what it does, and...
Well, yeah, the first clip you aired, Baldwin was speaking to the note to the issue of segregation and how segregation is really based in ignorance, and it promotes ignorance, because to be separated from something denies you the opportunity to be educated, to be informed, to be aware, or to understand. And so the more we find ourselves segregated, as we live here in the Midwest and in Kansas City, which is one, I think, in the top 10 most segregated cities in the country, then we are doing ourselves a disservice. And it's difficult to understand, to respect, to appreciate the attributes, the contributions of another person or another race if you totally isolate yourself from that group. Furthermore, I think the challenge for us is to listen to Baldwin as he spoke about who created the race problem in America. Yes, to understand that white people have to take responsibility for solving the problem, because white people created the problem.
Absolutely.
White people defined the institution of racism. Mm-hmm. Black people did not. And so to expect us to solve that problem is totally ridiculous. It's just counterintuitive. It makes no sense.
Do you worry at all that a white solution to that problem would have its own problems?
I'm not sure what you mean. Because of a denial to address it? Yes. You know, so I think the challenge for white people rests in the fact that those white people who consider themselves to be progressive, liberal-minded, inclusive people
can still be racist.
Because of their silence. You know, silence is probably one of the most deadly tools in promoting oppression. I mean, because basically silence empowers and encourages the oppressor. It does nothing for the oppressed. Mm-hmm. So when you are within your circle of friends and you are liberal-minded, but you hear racially charged language and you do not address it, or you are a part, you are party to racially motivated policies and institutions, and you do nothing to arrest them, your silence is oppressive.
Well, it's complicity.
And it's consent.
It's consent.
Let's hear from Angela from Kansas City, Missouri, who's calling in. Hi, Angela.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How about you? Tell us what you're thinking about.
Thank you. I am with Showing Up for Racial Justice Kansas City, and we are a group that organizes white people for racial justice. And I really agree with all of the panelists that, you know, racism is a white problem. James Baldwin, as the panelists mentioned, really did hold up a mirror to white America, and it's up to us to look into that mirror and to see ourselves in the ways in which our own racism, both individually and systemically, you know, turn us, as Baldwin said himself, into monsters of a kind. I think it's our responsibility to really take a hard look at ourselves and then take action.
Can you talk to me more about how you personally do that, how you personally have done that?
It's been a long journey. I think where I'm at now, I spend a lot of my time doing anti-racist organizing with Surge, and also my personal life, having conversations with my parents, having conversations with friends. You know, I don't have a family that has, you know, sort of the stereotypical, like, you know, racist uncle that's spouting off on Facebook or something like that. But I think that's important, is that when we have progressive people in our lives, you know, who consider themselves to be liberal and open-minded, you know, we're still swimming in a racist culture that's around us 24/7. So we need to have conversations with people that we think are like-minded, because we all have work we need to do.
Well, thanks for that call, Angela.
Thank you so much.
Does anyone have a James Baldwin passage or thought or idea to take us out on that just really, like, we can't leave without talking about this?
I bet we all do, but I'll defer to my co-guests.
I've given a couple. I really think the quote about the minstrel show, I think the lines that was written in, I believe it was Go Tell It on the Mountain, is that Black people die by a death of 1,000 cuts, the death of a landlady, the death of the landlord, the death of the employer, the death of the boss. And I think that there is a way in which dominant culture, white America, is just not aware of how oppressive it is to think about race on a daily basis, as people of color have to, and the privilege that moves forward that people who are not of color don't have to. And so that death by 1,000 cuts really responds to me of what it feels like to be in our world, even when we're doing well, even as we're moving forward, the death by 1,000 cuts, and those 1,000 cuts can happen in one day.
You know, something that comes up a lot is just the idea in his writing of facing fears and not turning back from them. Mm-hmm. Is that something that resonates for you just in the work that you do?
Absolutely.
Facing fears?
Absolutely. I think that to facilitate, consult around cultural competencies, around restorative practices, as Mr. Gilmore said, we cannot be reconciliatory until we actually realize that there's something to reconcile, that we cannot restore until we know what we're coming back to. And I think to face that and to know that I'm speaking to people that oftentimes don't want to hear what I have to say, I face my fears on that all the time, and being unflinching and unwilling to not do so.
Well, Cecilia Belzer-Patton, thank you for joining us. Cecilia is the co-founder of Just Systems,
yes,
a counseling firm specializing in social justice. Thank you. And we're also here with Gwen Grant of the Urban League. Thank you.
Thank you.
And D. Rashawn Gilmore of Blackout.
A pleasure as always, Gina. Yeah.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.